Hey, everybody. Welcome to Movie Crush. Charles W. Chuck Bryant here at the home studio, Pond City Market, Atlanta, Georgia. And this week in the studio, everyone, part of the Friends and Family Edition, I have my old friend, one of my dear bros, and I don't throw that word around, trust me, Chad Crowley. Chad is an old friend. We work together on the Stuff You Should Know TV show. Chad owns and runs a production company called School of Humans. He is very busy now, which is great, and has really made a name for himself developing TV and documentaries. And he's actually even doing a podcast with us now that you can look forward to called Hell and Gone in the future. Look for that great, great true crime podcast. But Chad directed and produced and co-wrote all of the Stuff You Should Know TV show episodes for us. When we had our show about 6 or 8 years ago with Science Channel, Chad became a really, really good friend very quickly. We are brothers from another mother, park our cars in the same garage. We are from similar places and have similar taste. And he is someone who, he's just a very, very good dude who I trust with anything, more so than maybe many other people that I've met in the world. Chad is a man of integrity and very trustworthy, honest, good guy to the bone, and has great taste and has done some cool work in his life. We talk about some of his work through the years with outsider artists and folk artists, and kind of unpack his career in advertising, which basically led to him saying, screw this, can't do this anymore, I'm out of here. And Chad is an ambitious guy who I always would want in my corner and will always be in his corner. And we talked about Chinatown, one of the great, more perfect, if not perfect, movies of all time, from Robert Towne and Jack Nicholson and Robert Evans and Roman Polanski. And we talk a little bit about Polanski and what art coming from genuine creeps and how to view art from people who have done very bad things. We don't have the answers, but we certainly get into that a little bit. But it was a great pleasure to talk to Chad about Chinatown and really dig into this movie. So if you haven't seen it, see it first, because it's one of the all-time greats. And then tune in and listen as we unpack Chinatown with Chad Crowley.
So what do we do? Tell me how to do this.
We just rap, man. That's something you and I can do all day long.
Yeah, exactly.
I was thinking about you the other day when I was wondering what movie you were going to pick.
What did you think?
I don't know. I mean, you came at me with Blazing Saddles, which, I mean, you know how I feel about that movie.
I do.
It's one of the great comedies of all time.
We could change the plan right now, Chuck.
But I was like, oh, man, it's just such sensitive times. And with that movie through today's lens, and so you went with a Roman Polanski movie.
Yeah, I thought about that afterwards. I have some things to say about that, though, that hopefully will
we'll hold on to that.
Provide any cover. But my perspective, if you care to have it on,
I do.
on Blazing Saddles is, isn't it the ultimate? If you can satirize those characters in that way, isn't that the ultimate statement of tolerance and being open, you know, in ways that maybe it was just still too sophisticated to come through?
Well, I mean, when you look at Blazing Saddles, the idiots in that movie are the white rednecks.
Precisely.
And the smartest, most clever character is Cleavon Little.
Right. Isn't that
I for guess, sure?
And then at the end with all the gay guys and stuff, like,
oh yeah,
he has it right. Is my but I can get
well. Richard
why.
Pryor was a co-writer on that movie too.
Was he? I don't think I knew that.
Oh yeah, yeah. He co-wrote that with Mel Brooks and I think like one other person.
My story now, is every day for one summer. We went to Jason Hembree's house. We played poker using Better Cheddars. These little shitty cheese crackers. And we watched Blazing Saddles until his mom got home every day for one summer.
And why? Because he had to turn it off?
Well, yeah. And she just kicked us out.
Right.
Time,
oh,
know?
I thought you meant
so we were just
of,
these little, you know, dirty, unwashed, latchkey kids.
Mm-hmm.
And we watched it every day. I bet we watched it 100 times.
I've It's on, up there for me too.
So, but I did not know that Richard Pryor wrote it. That's interesting.
He was a co-writer, and I think he wrote. I think the thought is when people hear that they think that he wrote a lot of the Cleavon Little stuff, because like Richard Pryor is a black guy, so he wrote for the African American character, but apparently that's not the case, and he wrote a bunch of the other stuff.
It's a really sophisticated comedy.
Yeah. So. Comedy, I mean, you could for sure never make that today as is.
I don't think. You know.
Unless like Spike Lee made it as a, you know, an uber statement.
Yeah. I guess that's unfortunate that you can't make that movie now, if in my view. Although maybe Tarantino's doing some stuff like that. Like, remember that scene in
that's
Django?
True. Yeah.
Is it Django?
Well, I don't know. Pick a movie.
Well, I think it was. Were those, it was like a big mob of angry dudes on horses, and they like rode in and they had sacks on their head.
Yeah, the Klansmen couldn't get the masks right.
Right, and he's like, now hang on just a damn minute. My wife stayed up all night last night making these goddamn things. You know,
yeah, sure.
Like, clearly an homage to that movie.
Yeah, and clearly saying, like, these people are the biggest idiots on the planet.
Yeah. And it was a super funny moment in a really heavy film that was a little preachy or whatever, but I think it was Django. Anyway.
So for the benefit of listeners, I know where you grew up, but and that you and I are good old friends. But tell everyone where you're from, because I'm curious to unpack a bit of this.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know how interesting it is, but so like you, I grew up here just south of the city in a tiny place called Rex. Jonesboro and Rex are kind of interchangeable there, where I grew up. Tiny little town with a mill and a creek and a baseball field. And it was a weird place. It was a suburb of Atlanta, maybe 20 miles from here. Very diverse, though. So we had a huge Cambodian population.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Huh.
And we also were probably... Of non-Cambodian people, we were probably half and half African-American and Caucasian. So everything was kind of mashed up in our community.
That's the South, man. It gets such a bad rap. The South is so much more tolerant than people realize.
Yeah, I don't know that I would call it tolerant, but it was just that was the mix.
Sure.
We were stuck on that boat. And
can be tolerant, brother.
It was, so I've thought about it thought about writing stories, like a series of, you know, my attempt at a Faulknerian kind of world based on that world.
Yeah.
Which I would call tar water, which is this notion of like these creatures that are sort of still have at least one foot stuck in the primordial sludge, you know, and maybe a web foot here or there. And I was definitely one of those kids. I can show you some really interesting pictures, but that are, you know, trying to figure it out just like we all are.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is that small community has produced all kinds of artists, and I don't know why that is. So you have a very prominent classical composer who I grew up with. His name's Joel Puckett.
No way.
Yeah. He's, I don't know. He's done a bunch of stuff, conservatory this and, you know, whatever that. We've got a couple of prominent opera singers, Michael Redding, also same exact, and a lot of stuff like that.
Wow.
So maybe it was definitely a Southern Gothic kind of life, though. I mean, there was, you know, there were a lot of maladies, you know, people with no eyes and not or like one eye and stuff, and lots of fighting and not a lot of shirts.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing.
A lot of bare chests.
That's the way I remember it. I'm sure that anyone listening that's from there may have.
I bet it wasn't a whole lot different than me growing up in Stone Mountain.
I bet it wasn't.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah. I'm sure it was very similar. We had, so its claim to fame is that it is the town that Gone with the Wind is based in. Tara is Jonesboro.
No shit.
That's right. So there is a, still there today. It's now just this sort of cheesy tourist attraction, but it was called Stately Oaks. And that is the,
I think I've heard of that, yeah.
The cotton plantation that Tara is based on and styled after and so forth. So when Margaret Mitchell was writing the book, she's from here, right down the street. she had an uncle or something that lived. I don't know if her family lived in that house or if she was just had some proximity to it.
Mm-hmm.
But she came from a wealthy family and they had lots of land holdings and stuff. And so she would go there, and that's how the whole thing came about.
But you grew up kind of like me, running barefoot through the woods, jumping in creeks and picking up crawdads and salamanders and jumping bikes and
shooting.
No parental oversight.
No, definitely not. if you weren't shooting at a spray paint can with a BB gun, it was because you were shooting at your brother.
Right.
Or a neighbor. Yeah, it was that.
I didn't get a BB gun till later.
My brother still has two BBs lodged in his in his baby fat.
It's like Royal Tenenbaums. Ben Stiller had a BB in his knuckle from where Royal had shot him when they were kids.
Yeah.
His father shot him.
Yeah.
Well, what I'm curious about, though, is like the Chad I know, who has like become one of my brothers, is a man of discerning tastes and goes very deep on the right kinds of culture and the best movies and authors and books. And I know where you're from. I know who you are now. And there's a bit of a delta between those two things. And I know your family to a certain degree. And like, I know the influences weren't coming in from there probably. So like, where did you, what set you on that path toward culture?
It's a good question. I had the great fortune of meeting, the short answer is a teacher.
Oh.
Her name was Linda Daughtry. She's still a friend of this day.
Wow.
She and her husband, Tommy, who would later be a mentor of mine, they live up in the mountains now, and we now take the kids and go stay with them, and they have the life that we hope to have when we retire. But she took me under her wing right before high school and had heard about me because I was like into painting and all this stuff. And not saying that there was like a prodigy quality to it, but like I was clearly like tracking in that way. And
sure.
So she had heard about me in a small community and she reached out. She actually went to our church and like found me at church and said, "Hey, I just want to let you know, like, I I'm here to help and, you know, and everything." So
do you feel different, Chad?
Yeah.
You're like, yeah, I do.
So just that, whatever that validation or whatever you want to call it, I think gave me an awful lot of kind of running room to explore a lot of things I'd been thinking about. And so, I was exploring what I knew to explore, but the world that I knew of was pretty small.
Yeah.
So she brought me in and said, "Look, here's Salvador Dali and here's, you know, so many other things."
Yeah.
And I think Wagner and, you know, just all these things. And I think she was smart enough. I mean, she understood that was probably all it was going to take for me.
Yeah.
Was just to know that these things were there and to be able to start feeding from them. I think she could see there was maybe a hunger I didn't know that I had.
Mm-hmm.
And it did. It made all the difference. I went from sort of drawing like, RoboCop.
Right.
Like exploring Marcel Duchamp and how to, you know, actually express myself as an artist instead of just do this thing I could do with my hand and draw things that look like things I'd seen.
Yeah.
And then it just really ballooned from there. She encouraged me to pick up a guitar, which I did. Just that being able to play those three chords in the way I wanted to play them or whatever in the early days.
Man, that early teacher influence can be so huge. You know?
Yeah.
And I know that the urge for a teacher to, especially in a place like Jonesboro, to identify like this and pluck it and, you know, it sounds a little elitist to say like, you know, this guy is special and I'm going to pluck him out because he's got talent and I don't want him. But the road for a lot of those guys was community college and
totally.
The case of beer and the fight on the weekends and, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that was the reality of it.
Yeah, and I certainly wasn't the only one, you know?
Not to knock community college, you know?
No, of course. By the way, have you seen Last Chance U? We should talk about that. Great show.
I haven't.
Netflix. It's amazing.
Yeah?
I certainly wasn't the only one. Linda had a massive influence on a lot of people, and I was talking earlier about all these people that became artists. I think she had a lot to do with just creating that culture in this little public high school that, you know, sort of caused that to happen.
I got a note from a, I had this teacher 1 year in high school, an English teacher, and I think she only taught at our school for a year. It was one of those things, like, you know how most teachers are just like legends.
Yeah.
And like they taught your older brother and older sister, and then you go through and they're still there today. But she only taught there 1 year, and I had her. And I remember she wrote in my yearbook something about, I'll have to go back and see exactly what it was, but something like, you're going to make it one day. You're a good writer and like a talented kid.
How did that make you feel? What did it cause you?
It meant a lot to me. And I think, I mean, I'm not going to lie and say that like, and from that moment on, like I pursued the arts because I fucked around forever.
Yeah.
And didn't make any headway career-wise until my mid-30s.
Yeah.
For God's sakes. But it meant a lot to me. I just didn't, and I've talked to other guests about this, I didn't know it was possible to be a director or a writer or work in the movies. From where we came from, I didn't know that you could do that.
Yeah.
Like you could get those jobs. But you had to be kind of born into it.
The height of culture and art in my upbringing was like Bob Ross. And
I've been watching lately, by the way, on Netflix.
Yeah, yeah. What I could find on PBS really represented. So, you know, Grumbacher and these cooking shows. Mm-hmm. And there was a show called Secret City, which was like a Canadian drawing show that I was fascinated with.
Oh, that's cool.
And the height of literature was probably reading Rainbow, you know. So having those horizons kind of greatly expanded by just one person can make the difference.
Well, what about when it came time for like movies? I mean, there's nothing wrong with growing up on RoboCop and Die Hard for sure.
Yeah.
But what, like, you've got brothers. Did you guys have family night as movies? Did you go out? I know your dad was very important to you.
Yeah. My dad was big into movies and he sort of had this, he had really good taste in films. Obsessed with Sergio Leone.
I was about to say, probably Westerns and war movies.
Yeah. And Charles Bronson.
Of course.
So what I knew of film came from what we could see on a Saturday night on, you know, Channel 69 or whatever the TCM of the day was.
By the way, that's not a sexual joke for you people out there.
Channel 69?
Like, no, Channel 69 was a real channel growing up here in Atlanta.
Yeah, for you younger listeners, that's on the UFH side of the dial.
That's right.
I don't know the difference between VHF.
UHF.
UHF, sorry.
Yeah.
UHF, yeah. So the first movie that my dad ever took me to was a movie called Christine, Stephen King's movie.
Sure.
About a demented car.
Yeah, and starring the future great director, Keith Gordon.
Really?
Yeah, he's directed some really good movies.
The guy, the main guy?
The dude from Back to School.
I had no idea.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So yeah, that was, and I was surely not supposed to be in there. I mean, it's a classic story. Like, my dad wanted to see it, and that was how.
Right.
You know, I heard you talking to Dax the other day, and same kind of thing. It was like,
yeah.
I think the second movie I ever saw was called Tough Turf, which was one of these sort of like a teen grindhouse kind of thing. I don't even remember what it was, but I feel like it had like James Spader or something in it. I'm sure somebody can look it up, but it was totally like scantily clad, very, you know, 80s kind of young ladies.
And yeah.
That my dad said, you know, that was what we were going to see that Saturday night. So,
and what about at home? The VCR was running a lot, or
we rented a VCR for a while.
Oh, which is those days!
What you could do. We got one eventually.
How much was a VCR back then?
It seemed like it was $10,000,
but it was probably like,
I have no idea,
200.
I know when we got one, my uncle Frankie, who awesome dude, Lucy's like great character. We should write something about him someday. He was a used car salesman. And I just remember late at night one time, he lived in Memphis, but for whatever reason, my mom said, Frankie's coming over. He's bringing us a VCR. And we were like ecstatic, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because we, you know, it was totally embarrassing to be in the, we didn't have Blockbuster. We had Home Run Pizza and Video.
Right.
And you'd be standing there with your little rentable VCR, you know, trying to look cool. And there was no way to do that. So we were excited. And at 10 o'clock, Frankie shows up. And he's a little sawed-off dude, shorter than I am. And he's carrying it. And he's in a box truck. Like, he's got a box truck full of VCRs. And I'm like, I'm asking my dad, I'm like, what is this? And dad's, it's never mind.
Sure,
just watch the VCR. So. That's how we got a VCR.
Were they stolen?
I got to believe they were warm, if not blazing hot.
He got a good deal.
I doubt he stole them, though. I'm sure there was a secondary market through which he...
Yeah, some shady business going on.
Yeah. Loving them.
Well, that VCR, I mean, I grew up... We didn't get cable on... You know, I grew up on a dirt road at first. And it just sounds like out in the country. It really wasn't. It was an Atlanta suburb.
Right.
But it was on a street that wasn't a development. It was just 8 or 9 houses. And it was a gravel road till I was like, I don't know, man, like 10.
Yeah.
And it's so funny. I remember when they paved it and how smooth that motherfucker felt.
Oh, yeah.
When we first drove over it. But we didn't get cable as a result of being sort of an off street till a little bit later.
Yeah.
I didn't have cable when I was 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. I think I got it when I was around 11, kind of near the launch of MTV. And it's that HBO, like when we got HBO, that literally changed my life.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I remember we didn't have HBO. I remember my cousin David climbed the pole.
Oh, yeah.
And like untwisted the thing. And like we had it for a week until they spotted it and they came out and got it. But one of the neighbors had it. And so that was like if you couldn't go to the movie theater, that was the next best thing, was to go across the street to the neighbors who had it. And there was an entire universe in their TV box that had never been made available to us.
Did you have aspirations for filmmaking back then, or was it more about drawing and art? Or was that even on your radar?
A lot of unguided aspiration to do something awesome, you know?
Really?
So if we were building BMX tracks, it was like, we're going to build this BMX track. It's going to be a commercial enterprise. It's going to be the most artful and successful BMX track. I would enlist a big group of people to do that. And then they would lose interest before I would. And, you know, and so there were a lot of failed ventures.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always painting and sculpting and,
That really explains a lot.
Does it?
Yeah, because you own and run your own production company now. Like you weren't, and I know you, dude, you've never been satisfied to half-ass anything.
Yeah, no, that's probably true. Thank you. So a lot of like failed carnivals and, you know, a lot of these kind of things. But I didn't know. I, until much later, I had no idea that like filmmaking was an actual art or a craft that, you know, so it took a while. It took kind of getting out into the world, and I became a graphic designer and sort of began to make my living.
And your college experience was?
It was a dropout situation.
Uh-huh.
The teacher I mentioned, Linda Daughtry, her husband was the art professor at the local college.
Uh-huh.
I'd gotten to know him because of her, and so he said, just come do whatever you want in my room. And so that's what I did for a couple of years, and, you know, chased a bunch of stuff, and ultimately just decided to learn how to design stuff and just sort of, like, taught myself how to use all the tools to be a professional graphic designer. I started a little design agency. In 1998, 99, sold it in 2001. Had not a great stack of money, but enough to kind of figure out what I wanted to do next. And got into advertising, became an art director.
Yeah, and I love the story, the Little Debbie story.
Which one? There are a lot.
Well, no, I'm not talking about your personal obsession with eating Little Debbie's.
Yes.
I'm talking about when you were working on set on a job, and that's when you sort of knew to get out of there.
Yeah. So, So advertising, what advertising gave me was, it was the first time I ever saw like a camera shoot something, because we concepted a TV spot, which I played it cool. Like I had done that a million times, but I really had not. And then, you know, whatever it was, a month later, it was time to shoot it. And the way it works in the ad agency business is they bring in an outside production company, and the creatives who had developed the spot, wrote and art directed the concept. They go out on set and they work with the commercial director, and the shot and the spot gets produced. When I saw that world, that was the first time I'd ever understood that that was really, I mean, I'm sure I'd understood what a director was before that, but that was the first time I was like, oh, okay, there's that guy. There's that guy. I want to be that. I want to be that guy over there.
Mm-hmm.
It's really kind of like pulling all the strings.
Yeah.
I realized that was a culmination of kind of everything I'd worked on up to that point, because he's composing a frame. He's thinking, he's working with the art director. In this case, it was a puppet in the shot, in the spot. So, you know, I had been making puppets my whole life in various ways. And so, and then he's like, you know, calling this and that. And he was part business and part art. And I was like, yeah, man, I don't know how I do this, but that's my guy right there. So that kind of was a moment when I was like, I'm going to figure out how I do this now, or do that.
Yeah.
You know, starting now. A couple of years went by. We did that. Made a lot of spots, bank spots, whatever, whatever. And I just, there came a time when advertising's sole objective is to sell product.
Yeah.
Whatever that product is. And it is an artful business. I mean, there's a lot of great creativity in that, in that business. Some of the best art and some of the best film directors ever started in that world, and you know,
and still working commercials. Sure.
You know, Ang Lee, Wes Anderson, you name it.
Yeah. I worked on a spot with, Tony Scott.
Yep.
And, Michael Bay.
Yep.
Did not work with Christopher Guest, but he was in an office I was in. I mean, those guys are all repped.
Oh man. I mean, Bennett Miller, Spike Lee. I mean, it's so many, you know, so.
Errol Morris.
Yeah. Errol Morris is that, I mean, for a long time.
That's where he makes his money.
Yeah. I was going to say, that's how he remains to be Errol Morris. However, there came a time when I had more or less three projects on my desk at that time. One was to sell Little Debbie snacks as an on-the-go snack in the morning.
For like, kids.
Mom can throw it at them as they hop in the minivan.
Right.
As a breakfast. And the tagline, I don't know if it is still this, but it used to be, for a long time, unwrap a smile. So I was being told.
Boy, that's Don Draper City.
Yeah. The other two projects on the desk was for a bank.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, the brief was, sell home equity lines of credit to people to pull the equity out of their house and put in a pool or go on a vacation.
Mm.
And then the third was health insurance for a major, gigantic, world's largest health insurance company, in which premiums were rising for no reason. And not that you get the whole straight skinny as the ad agency, but you do get a little bit of a look under the hood of sort of what the real motivations are for certain things. And it just felt wrong to me. And so I realized that I was contributing to some kind of problem. I didn't necessarily understand what it was, but there was this sort of axis of evil on my desk, and it represented the ability for me as an artist to express myself and obviously to provide and make a living. And I knew it would be a lot of fun to do these things, but there was this underlying problem that I was really struggling with, you know? And sometime just before that, or maybe just after that, we'd also been working for a major power company, huge power company. And we went into this room and they said, well, here's the deal, guys. We don't know how you're going to solve this. It was like for a big brand campaign, you know, sort of anthemic, like we are so-and-so or whatever. I forget exactly what it was. But I just remember this guy in this very nice suit in this very glossy conference room says, the deal is we have 200 years of coal on hand to burn.
Mm.
It's your guys' like problem to figure out how to make that okay.
Yeah.
That was, I'm paraphrasing, of course, but that was the mission.
Wow.
So I was like, man, I just don't think I can do this.
Yeah.
So you
had sort of a Jerry Maguire moment, right?
I guess so. But I spent about a year trying to get fired, and every time, like, I would just everything I did just got me promoted, and then I won like, the company award, like the little crystal thing, like the like the best employee on planet Earth, and all this stuff. But eventually, I just decided to jump out and give it a shot and do the things I wanted to do. By that time, I had made a documentary about a small community in rural Alabama, called G's Bend, and had begun working on a bunch of movie ideas and anything I knew to work on.
Music video for Ben Soli?
That was a little later, but but I had done some music videos prior to that, and was just figuring out how to be the guy behind the camera.
Is that G's Bend anywhere online, that doc?
It's called Birds of Eden, and it is not. It is still, it remains unreleased for a bunch of reasons, but...
Is it finished?
It's not finished. I mean, somebody might think it is if they saw it, but it's got a lot of work. But for anybody unfamiliar with G's Bend, remarkable, remarkable, important, hugely important place for American culture and just American history and life. It is in a tiny sort of northwest corner of Alabama on the Alabama River. It is in a crook of the river that created a sort of almost a walled off
community
peninsula.
Yeah.
700 community members, all African American. And it was a former slave plantation. So most of the people there are direct descendants of slaves. There is a high percentage of people with the same last name, which was the slaveholder's last name, Petway. But what came out of that, during the New Deal era, FDR deemed G's Bend the kind of the poorest place in America. And the 40 acres and a mule program that, sort of cliche actually happened as part of the New Deal, and one of those places was in G's Bend.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody got 40 acres, a small house, a smokehouse, and a mule to kind of tenant farm their lands. What came out of that place was some of the greatest art in American history, particularly in quilts. Those quilts were made not as an expression of art, or at least the people there knew they were creating art. They were just artful people creating things out of necessity. So,
yeah, a quilt to keep them warm.
Yeah.
That is also beautiful.
Right. Out of grandpa's old overalls or whatever they could find.
My grandmother Bryant, my dad's mom, was a quilter.
Yeah.
And each of the grandkids has one of her quilts now. And amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
Handmade.
Hand-stitched every ounce of it. So today, because of the tireless efforts of some dear friends of mine that I met and kind of introduced me to that world, the Arnett family, G's Bend is renowned all over the world. Those quilts now sell for stacks of money.
Yeah.
And helps all of those women primarily to live very, very comfortable lives. Their art is now displayed in every major museum in America for the most part.
So cool.
They have their own U.S. stamp collection, the stamp series with G's Bend quilts on it. Numerous books and documentaries have been made there.
It's so awesome.
Our doc was about the music, the sort of progression of field music and church music and how that has lived on, mostly through being passed down orally in a small community like that.
Yeah, that's something that I really love, the sort of your efforts, and then our friend Matt Arnett and his dad, and the efforts that you guys have all put forth to work and kind of bring attention and to outsider artists, I guess is the lame way to say it.
Yeah.
But people like Lonnie Holly.
Yeah, contemporary artists, Lonnie Holly, and just to go back, just to connect it to me a little bit, meeting Lonnie Holly, and I was definitely a late bloomer, I mean, like I'm all this stuff's happening in my 20s.
Yeah.
Mid-late 20s. I met Lonnie Holly, who, as a part of that G's Bend, he's not from G's Bend, he grew up in Birmingham. He is on level with the greatest artists in world history, certainly in American history. Think of Sun Ra, you can't really define Lonnie Holly.
Yeah.
But I met him, and at the time I did, just something drew me to him, and he immediately became one of my dearest friends. And he was living in this shabby warehouse in Birmingham, Alabama, creating this world-class art, trying to figure out how to make ends meet on a daily basis.
Yeah.
And eventually, through his own effort and the efforts of many others around him, primarily Matt Arnett and Bill Arnett, his art now is displayed. And he works in a lot of different mediums. From found objects is probably what most people know him for. But he's a musician, and
Now
he has a 5 record deal.
His music,
at Sub Pop,
it's just like, I mean, Sun Ra is a pretty good example, but
yeah.
He's just this this sage and philosopher, and
yeah.
He's just out there, but so connected to the world, yeah. And like, it's hard to hear his music, which is just haunting and weird, and it's not like any kind of, it doesn't follow any
yeah.
contemporary musical patterns or
it's
anything
just
like
pure,
that.
It's just pure...
Pure expression.
Yes, pure expression. He does not write or think about what he's going to do before he sits down in the microphone's role. He then plays
unbelievable.
And does whatever he's going to do. And this is true for his live show, too. And he never plays it again. Sometimes the song's a 15-minute epic called, you know, 6 Space Shuttles and 144,000 Elephants. And it's, and it's this long kind of morality tale that gets
yeah.
you back to what's wrong with the world, which is a lot of the themes that Lonnie expresses in many ways. And sometimes it's him banging on a lawnmower with, you know, Bradford from Deer Hunter or
yeah.
whatever.
And, yeah, yeah.
And it's a, you know, 30-second little piece of kind of a soundscape, you know.
It's really amazing. I mean, he could have... no one could have ever known about him.
Yeah.
And people throw around the word genius, but like, he's a genius just as much as a Salvador Dali or a, and I know that Matt kind of abhors the word outsider art. The reason I used it is because that is an instant descriptor to people.
Oh, of course.
But it's art, and
yeah.
it should not be labeled outsider art. It's just as valid and important as anything else.
Absolutely.
You know, that is trotted out at the Met or the Guggenheim or the High Museum here.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know when this will come out. Lonnie's on tour with Animal Collective right now.
Oh, really?
He is?
This will be out in a few weeks. I'm short on interviews, so.
Good.
Hopefully, yeah, man, if you get a chance out there to see and support Lonnie Holly, just check it out.
Yeah.
I love that he's an Animal Collective. That makes sense.
it has, at least in my own experience, it has the chance to change your life. I will say that.
For sure. I'm glad we remembered to talk about that.
Yeah.
Well, let's get into Chinatown.
Oh, yeah.
AFI's number 21. That list may be bullshit, but it's number 21.
I think it got demoted because I remember seeing it.
It may have because yeah. the list.
How does that work?
Well, the list was originally in 1998, and then I think at 10 years in 2008, they did another version.
Right. Yeah.
So it was probably higher because I was surprised it wasn't a top 10.
Yeah.
11 Academy Award nominations. It only won one for Best Screenplay, The Great Robert Towne. We'll talk about this kind of fucking perfect script
yeah.
all throughout. But it lost many of those awards to Godfather 2. It had the unlucky
yeah.
release date to
yeah.
come out the same year as that movie. Although Jack Nicholson lost to Art Carney for Harry and Tonto. Faye Dunaway lost, I think rightfully, to Ellen Burstyn for Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore.
Yeah.
It's hard to deny that one. But released in 1974, directed by Roman Polanski. We'll unpack that in a minute. Written by Robert Towne, produced by Robert Evans. And it's just one of those movies that that Robert Evans era of the 70s filmmaking was just sort of this iconic period in Hollywood, I think.
Yeah.
Even though as immediately with these opening credits when they start rolling, it does not feel at all like a movie made in the 1970s. It just smacks of a classic 40s neo-noir.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Or I guess film noir at that point.
I mean, when you saw it the first time, did you have that context or did you see it thinking?
I did not. I knew it was, I can't remember my first experience with it. And I've definitely seen it a couple of times over the years, but watching it two nights ago, it was just like revelatory how perfect of a film it is.
Yeah. Yeah, for me, I mean, I guess I've heard people say this about it too, that it really does sit in the canon of the actual film noir films as opposed
yeah.
to sitting, you know, alongside of Raging Bull and Taxi Driver and
mm-hmm.
you know, even Godfather. I mean, at least to a great extent. And I think, I don't know if that was an intention that those guys had when they made it, but
yeah.
it's almost not neo noir. It's like classical noir.
Yeah.
You know, maybe because it's so. It is so perfect. I agree that it's perfect. I feel like I've got like a couple of problems with it. I would just love to know if they're just my hangups or yours, but not that we should start there. But I
no,
just
let's
don't...
start there.
Okay, well, they're sort of toward the ending. I don't know if that's okay, but
yeah, that's fine.
But well, first, let me say, it is a truly as somebody who tries to create things, mm-hmm. And of course you are one of those as well. It is just a daunting task to set out, in my view, to set out to create something that is going to set alongside of or fit within or even be an homage to such a legendary canon of work like film noir or whatever it is, right? To sit down and go, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to write a film noir.
Yeah, that's pretty intimidating.
Yeah. So I think to me, I always feel much more comfortable and feel like I'm in much easier territory when I'm walking out on the thinnest limb I can find, because mm-hmm. I know I'm the only one out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that there's some sort of, you know, insecurity that's driving that, right? Because if I'm out there and pretty much everything I've ever done has some facet of like, there's nobody that's really kind of done exactly this, and mm-hmm. there's probably a good reason, but at least I'm alone, and when I fail, it can't be compared to anything. But for Town to sit down, I mean, and you know, look, he was a great writer, but I don't know that I would have, you know, in the time machine gone back and pointed to him, you know, and said,
right, like this is William Goldman or.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking about our mutual friend, Derek Brown.
Yeah.
Who's a great poet and just an amazing human being. And
yeah.
I remember the way he became an artist. He was in the U.S. Army during Gulf uh-huh. War, Desert Storm. And he's like in a foxhole. And he just had this idea to like rewrite the parts of the Bible that he thought could use a little punch up. And I'm like,
that's a very Derek Brown thing to do.
Yeah, but it's the same kind of thing in this case. To me, it's like, that's just not how I think. So anyway, so I just want to say, like, if you start there and then you achieve Chinatown.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's good stuff.
Like if that was their intent from the beginning and to have achieved that, this movie could have gone wrong in so many ways.
Yeah. And then also to use such, you know, inspired by a lot of true events with, you know, Mulholland and all the kind of water and power stuff of,
sure.
what, 30 years later or whatever. And to be able to weave that stuff in a way that feels very truthful, feels very factual almost, you know, like this was based on a true story almost.
Though,
of course, it's not. A huge task. But getting back to my problems with it, if we agree that it's a perfect movie, is in so much as a movie can be perfect.
Yeah.
The thing that has always bugged me is, and this is, I guess there's no spoiler alerts on a,
no,
on a show about
it's all spoiled.
Movies. When Noah Cross, who's kind of the, what is he? He's like the boss of Los Angeles. He's a very wealthy.
John Huston, man.
John Huston. My God.
What a talk about a statement.
Yeah.
Like, who should we get to play this guy? Oh, how about fucking John Huston?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
As far as gravitas goes, man, when he first comes on the screen.
Yeah, worst villain of all time in my book.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because it's not...
He's up there.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, to me, it's he's the worst villain because it represents, he represents somebody that's real,
mm-hmm.
you know, as opposed to...
Yeah,
you know,
you're totally right.
Lex Luthor or whatever, you know. So anyway, when he comes to J.J. Geddes, the main character played by Jack Nicholson, of course, and Jack Nicholson kind of has him dead to rights,
mm-hmm.
but then in come John Huston, Noah Cross's henchman, point a gun and say, it's just not worth it.
Mm-hmm.
You're done, right?
Yeah.
So Noah is admitting that he's gotten it right, that Jack has gotten it right.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter. Then, so he's holding a gun and he says, where's the girl, right? That's all Noah Cross wants is to find his daughter / granddaughter, which is the whole thing we should talk about.
Yeah, yeah, we'll get into that.
and Jack has, by this time, already hidden the girl
mm-hmm.
and Evelyn.
Uh-huh.
Why does he take them to her? Why can't he just say, I don't know where she is?
Why does Jack take them?
Yeah. The very next thing you see is they're in a car. The henchman still got the gun pointed at J.J. Geddes, Jack Nicholson. They roll into Chinatown, which is Chinatown's really only presence in the whole movie.
Well, except for being present throughout the whole movie.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, symbolically.
Symbolically. They pull right up to where she is.
Yeah.
I must have missed something.
Jeez, I don't know.
Feels like a huge story gap to me.
I never really thought about that. I mean, is it possible that he felt genuinely threatened that he would be killed if he didn't do that?
I mean, I suppose that's the only logical answer.
That's probably the implication, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. He's got that. Houston has that great line in that seat, though, where he goes, "You may think you know what you know what's going on,
yeah.
but you have no idea."
Yeah. Don't you feel like he
so intimidating?
I feel like he's got to have like denture breath. That guy.
Oh God. Yeah, I bet John Houston's breath was pretty bad.
Yeah, I mean, you'd want it. You'd want it.
It's like 100 years of coffee and cigarettes.
Yeah.
Well, jumping back to the beginning, one of my favorite. One of the best intros to me in movies. It was so, and this is part of the worship of the script that we'll have throughout this this dissection. But that intro scene when Burt Young is in there as Curly, you find out everything you need to know about Jake Gittes in that 3 minutes in that office.
Yep.
He shows him the photos of a woman in flagrante with you know, clearly shot from outside of a window. So you know immediately this guy's a private detective. He's chasing down unfaithful spouses for a living. And his first line, you know, Burt Young starts to freak out a little bit, grabs the blinds on the window. And Jack says, "Enough's enough. You can't eat the Venetian blinds. It just had them installed on Wednesday."
Yeah.
And that just kind of sums up who that man is, like beyond just being an awesome line. And there's so many great lines in here. But and then on the way out, he says, "You know, I'm not going to take your last dime." Like, he's not going to fleece this guy for money. Yeah. And that sets up, of course, the favor repay in the third act with Curly.
Yeah, exactly.
When he drives him out of the house and gets him away from the cops, Escobar. But it's just such an efficient way to set up who that character is. You know, everything you need to know about Jack, in that he is doing a job that he's not really proud of, and he's a man of integrity somehow.
Yeah, yeah. And there's all that. There's all those interesting nuanced details. Like, yeah, you kind of get the sense that he's just moved into that office. Everything's a little clean and perfect.
Yeah.
And yeah, he's talking about new blinds and it's that cream colored suit.
Yeah, he's dressed to the nine, sure.
Yeah. And everything just feels like dude's kind of got it. He's got it working here.
Yeah.
You know? I also think that in retrospect, certainly on first viewing, this isn't the case. You could pretty much learn everything you need to know about the movie, you know, in that scene too. I mean, there's a lot of clues laid in that movie, which is really, I mean, in that scene, and which is really, I think, what makes this movie so brilliant is how the clue pattern is laid out.
Oh man,
it's in a way
just
that
perfect.
You just never, with one shot, maybe I could pick on, but for the most part, you just never see the clue path being laid.
No, because you think. Well, he goes to the hearing about the new dam proposal, and all of a sudden you're like, what is this movie about? The original title of the movie was Water and Power.
Yeah.
Which, and it's sort of, I mean, it's about a lot of things, but you think like the central, first, all right, let's back up here. You think the plot is about this private detective who is chasing down Mulray's.
Yeah.
Affair that he's having.
Simple infidelity case.
Yeah. Infidelity case of this guy who is the engineer behind the new dam project for the LA city. Then all of a sudden you have this water and power plot emerge when they also a great scene when they're having that hearing and the farmer fucking runs his sheep through the court.
Get those goddamn sheep out of here.
Yeah, but it's like, man, it just sets up like this is what Los Angeles was in the night. Was it the 30s or early 40s?
They had it set in the 30s.
Yeah, the 30s is like L.A. was in, I mean, there was downtown and Chinatown and the burgeoning film business and stuff. But L.A. was still like out in the valley, just fucking farmland.
Oh, yeah.
And like sheep herders and shit. And it's hard to wrap our head around that now. But that does such a good job of setting up like L.A. as sort of a character in this movie.
Absolutely.
So you think it's an infidelity case. Then it has this great... I mean, it sounds, if you've never seen the movie, it sounds weird to say this water and power subplot about diverting water, but it turns out to be super interesting.
How fascinating.
And we, you know, let's go ahead and save the real reveal till the end of this discussion.
Yeah.
But you don't really know what's going on. And the way it unpacks these clues as you go is just brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And so I was thinking about Mulray. He's a guy who really is good at his job, clearly.
Yeah.
He's even, I think the way that they established that he's sort of the morally just character by saying, I will not build this dam that
right.
these guys want to build.
Yeah, like I made a mistake once.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to do it again.
Right. We ultimately see the consequences he pays for that.
Right.
And many other things. But he really, even though he barely says a thing in the movie other than that scene when he stands up at the podium before he's killed, you really get a sense that that's just a very interesting perspective to tell a story from, a mm-hmm. sort of municipal
yeah.
shit that nobody pays attention to.
Ever. Yeah, yeah.
Why would anybody pay attention to that?
Yeah. Yeah, and he's hired by what turns out to be a fake Miss Mulray. Diane Ladd comes in there, hires him to tail this guy when... and then we learn that he's being set up, that Jake is being set up, that J.J. Geddes is being set up. And it's sort of all a big setup at the beginning. It has nothing to do with the infidelity because the woman that he's with is not a mistress.
Yeah. I mean, she was just hired on. I think she was a working girl is what she calls herself on a later phone call.
Yeah.
So she was basically just a freelancer, probably unaware of the plot she was within. I think some interesting points there. What the guys who hired her clearly didn't know, and this is what I love about this movie, is that I feel like these characters are real human beings. I feel like
yeah.
their motivations are so real. It just feels like a true story, but I don't think they anticipated that JJ would go to the press.
Right.
Or maybe they did, and it was about just besmirching Mulray in public
mm-hmm.
to force him to bend to their will, which we find out later with Noah Cross had not been an issue up to that point. But
right.
for whatever reason, he was abstaining from doing the thing they needed him to do. And this just doesn't seem like any, I mean, you could just see this popping up in your Facebook feed today.
Right.
Maybe not to this extent, but with murders and stuff, but like, you know, leaning on someone to force a public works project to go your way.
Yeah.
Not even news anymore.
No. I mean, that's the history of America.
Yeah.
And they also, the, you know, there's that great scene in the barbershop where Nicholson's getting shaved and the guy next to him, and this kind of is such good character work. The guy's like, you know, hell of a way to make a living, you know, trailing people and taking pictures of people in their bedrooms. And Geddes is so defensive about that. He almost starts a fight with the guy, wants to.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, we should step outside and settle this.
Yeah.
But it says so much about that character, and that there's so many things going on in this movie that have nothing to do with the plot. Like, it's about this man also, J.J. Geddes, who worked as a cop in Chinatown, and it's never explained what happened there, but you know that he didn't want to play ball with whatever dirty business was going on with the cops, which is why he either got forced out or quit the police force. And became this private dick,
yeah,
doing this kind of schlum work that no one, that's not really respectable on its surface.
Right. Yeah. It's funny. That's your impression, because mine, and it probably all has to do with sort of how we come at the world, much less a movie. But for me, I always saw it that him saying, I do, you know, I do honest work or whatever
yeah.
the line is really, in. I always interpreted that was him telling himself that.
Yeah.
To soothe. And that whatever happened at the police station, based on how he's living his life now and
yeah.
the lifestyle that he's kind of propped up, that it was about being able to make money.
Right.
And I guess I know people that I feel like have kind of made that
yeah.
sell, you know,
uh-huh.
to go from maybe doing something that has sort of more of a more socially just
yeah.
purpose to something that just makes them be able to buy really sweet cream colored suit and rock it in your office, you know.
Yeah, and he has that line too, and I mentioned this line because we'll get to it again at the end, when I can't remember which character, but someone asks him what he did with the police force in Chinatown, and he says, as little as possible.
Yeah.
And it's sort of a throwaway joke line that becomes very important in the closing minutes of the
yeah.
movie.
Yeah.
So we'll get to that.
Yes.
But you know, Jake Geddes is in a sort of a bid for respectability which is why, like, after Mulray is murdered and dead, the case is kind of over, but he won't give it up because I think he knows that old cop instinct comes back where he knows that something's going on and he's just not going to let it lie.
Yeah. And
he does get hired by Houston, but between those moments, he's still investigating.
He is. I mean, he obviously sort of, like true film noir, he gets intimately involved with Evelyn Mulray there for a half a second, too.
Yeah.
And, perhaps his judgment is clouded. Somewhere in some probably slightly boring film critique of this film, I saw once that, and it may have been Ebert, I would have to go back and look, but somebody made the point that this film is actually not film noir, that it's actually a horror movie.
What?
And that there are many reasons, but one of the reasons was because Evelyn Mulray, played by Faye Dunaway, is really the most pure and sort of morally aligned character in the whole movie.
Yeah.
And therefore, because she's not a femme fatale, you don't have that element, and you can't have a film noir without a femme fatale.
Oh, interesting.
There was much more to it, and I'm sure. But anyway, yeah.
I tried to read some of the articles, like, examinations on this movie. Those are always good.
Yeah.
When you get a good deep dive.
Stuff.
Yeah, it's good stuff. We meet a couple of great henchmen, one of which is Roman Polanski, who, very famously, it's one of the most famous woundings in movie history when he...
Yeah.
And a great line, too, when he shows up, where'd you get the midget?
Yeah.
And Polanski sticks that knife up his nose and slits his nostril.
Yeah.
And that becomes a thing through the rest of the movie. He's got this big fucking bandage on his nose.
Yeah, it's pretty great. I feel like Polanski managed to fuck up a really easy job there as an actor, though.
He shouldn't have been in it,
yeah.
First of all.
Yeah.
It's very Tarantino-esque to wedge himself in there.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the other guy was good, the other tough, the big guy.
Oh, that guy was amazing. Yeah, Mulvaney or whatever it was.
Yeah. But Jack has the other great line about his nose. He said, I goddamn near lost my nose, and I like it. I like breathing through it, and I think you're still hiding something. And that's what I love about the script is it's got that great bit about I like breathing through it, but the key to that scene is I still think you're hiding something
right.
to Evelyn.
Yeah.
And she is.
Of course she
is. He's onto it
yeah.
from the beginning. But it's, again, we'll get to it, but it's so, comes out of nowhere the first time you see this movie.
Exactly. I mean, what she's hiding is beyond his comprehension, you would gather.
Yeah, but there are a couple little nuggets laid there as well. Like, when he first meets John Huston, he's, John Huston, very, one of the first things he wants to know is if he's slept with her.
Yeah.
And then when he first meets Evelyn, she's very reactive when he asks about the fight that her husband had with her father.
Yeah.
Like what that was all about.
Yeah. Yeah. You can tell that those two are very much, Evelyn and Noah Cross are very much keeping tabs on each other for very different reasons.
Yeah.
And one thing I'll say about Towne's writing on this film, or I know Polanski, I guess, did some uncredited rewrites. So I don't know who did what.
Nicholson?
Polanski did.
And Nicholson supposedly...
Really?
Wrote a lot of his own dialogue.
Is that right?
Well, that's what they say.
Well, what has always struck me about the Evelyn character is how absolutely, perfectly double entendre everything that comes out of that character's mouth is.
Yeah.
Everything she says can be interpreted on face value, which, of course, is where JJ is operating for
uh-huh.
most of the movie before she kind of really lays the straight skinny on him. Once you know and you go back and watch it, and then there's a lot more insight coming
yeah.
from her stuff, but there's obviously this whole other layer. She never lies to him once, really.
Yeah.
I'm sure I could get a good debate up on that, but I really don't think she actually lies to him once. What she does is it's that they're talking about completely different
right.
things each time.
Yeah.
And she's dancing around it. I mean, there may be some lies by omission for sure. But
yeah, I think you're probably right. Nothing stands out to me as an outright lie.
Yeah, I mean, when JJ says, he's talking about, the girlfriend or whatever, it's like, where you've got her hidden, and she's
right.
always got a way to kind of like answer it.
Yeah.
But never say,
Yeah. So, we first meet Noah Cross, and that's just like I said earlier, when John Huston just first appears on the screen, he's just larger than life. Like, I can't imagine, like, maybe John Wayne. Like, I can't imagine any other casting choice that would have been as much gravitas as that at the time. And he hires Jake to find the mistress of Mulray. So, you know, everyone's kind of hiring him to do different things. And I love it that each time he's sort of like, yeah, I'll have my secretary drop the contract.
Yeah.
And he's always taking the job.
Exactly.
You know, even though he's working for what turns out to be adversarial forces.
Yep.
But he always takes the job. But that's when, you know, the falling out with Mulray and Cross comes out, and Evelyn says it was about the water, and this whole kind of, like I said, it's unexpected that a subplot about a water diversion would be interesting, but it's fascinating. And I found this cool quote from one of those articles I read. It said, the water rights scandal at the heart of the film expresses how the ecological rape of the land has occurred in outrageous land development schemes that redirect the water's flow. And it reminds viewers that the days of abundant natural resources are past. The land has become barren due to the selfish manipulations of the rich and powerful businessmen. So it's not even about water.
Right.
It's about these powerful men in charge.
It is. It sort of, you know, reminds me of maybe the modern equivalent. Obviously, we have a lot of natural resource problems, particularly still in California.
Yeah.
But I think about gerrymandering.
Oh, yeah.
And kind of how the horse trading of that works.
We just did a Stuff You Should Know episode on that.
Oh, yeah?
A few weeks ago, yeah.
Yeah, so how that's happening in the shadows or kind of in plain sight, however you want to.
And allowed to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It feels the same to me.
And then John Huston has that great line upon that first meeting when he says, of course I'm respectable. I'm old. Politicians, ugly buildings, and whores all get respectable. They last long enough.
Yeah.
Like, can you imagine typing that shit?
Yeah.
Out, like, that's such a great line.
Yeah.
It's like one of the great lines.
And it's so believable coming out of that guy's mouth. I feel
for sure.
Didn't he, like, live in a castle and, like, I mean, like.
I don't know.
Yeah.
His daughter almost played the role. I think it was written for Jane Fonda, and then Angelica Huston almost played the role. And I don't know if I think she and Jack were together at this point, too, which would have been
interesting. I don't think I knew that. So that actually has a little of that, like, are you sleeping with my daughter?
Yeah, maybe. But, I don't know why they didn't go with her, but I mean, Faye Dunaway, of course, was a brilliant choice. Not a lot of outright violence in the movie. You have, you know, the nose slit, but there's that one great scene where Jake just kicks the shit out of that tough.
Yeah, yeah, at the nursing home.
Yeah, and she saves him. You know, he's about to get killed.
Yeah, that
by Polanski.
What? So that's a really great scene for a lot of reasons, because you start to realize how sophisticated this plot has been.
Yeah,
you know, and the what do you call him, the nursing home director guy or whatever,
yeah,
realizing that he's in on it, clearly. I mean, he's how Polanski character and the other guy, the you know, henchman, would have known he was even,
yeah, like,
were,
he gets in touch
there
with them, right?
He had, yeah,
they
were like, how
him
about we walk around by ourselves, he go, the dude disappears, and 5 seconds later,
yeah,
the henchmen are there. Of
yeah,
course
yeah,
he called them, because he's in on it, because how else would you get all of those residents of his place to buy the land?
Yeah.
And ultimately,
the plot, I mean, the plot is so, like, richly convoluted in the best way.
Yeah.
That they're diverting water to the valley secretly to, well, first of all, they're dumping runoff into the ocean.
Yeah.
That's where we first see Mulray when he trails him. But eventually they're going to divert water to the valley, which at that point was a barren wasteland, a desert, and they're buying up land parcels on the cheap through these folks in an old folks' home.
Yeah, in their names, without their knowledge. It reminds me of, and not to throw shade at the not with us anymore, but pretty much what Walt Disney did in Orlando.
Oh, yeah?
So there were... he was Walt Disney, so he couldn't just go down and buy however many, you know, tens of thousands of acres. So he didn't,
in the central swamp of Florida.
Yeah, yeah. He didn't swindle unknowing old people. So that part is obviously not accurate. But they set up all of these shell companies with these funny names, and like 500 entities or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
Purchased all the land, and they were all,
which became Disney World.
Everything funneled up to just Walt Disney buying land. Yeah.
Well, I think, I mean, I had Mike Hollingsworth in here from BoJack Horseman, and he's an animation history freak, and he was not too kind to Walt Disney either. So I think, like, the real story of that guy is not so pretty.
Yeah, it's usually the case. I mean, yeah. I hate to say it, but, like, if Noah Cross were a real guy,
mm-hmm.
and this many years had gone by, he would probably be more revered than hated, I bet.
Yeah.
You know? Look at Edison. I mean, there's so many.
Sure. You know. Well, especially back then, you know, when so many stories were not told.
Yeah, when you could hide.
Yeah. So that you have the classic love scene and that great, great scene. And again, with the script, the way they set that up is Jake sees the flaw in her eye. Like you have a black mark in the green part of your eye. And it's just an excuse to get close to her, but it's so sensual.
Yeah.
And kind of romantic, and it's just so well played.
It is. Do you know, maybe I've missed it, does the daughter, the granddaughter, does she have a defect? Does she have the same defect?
Oh, I don't know. That's an interesting thought.
Yeah. Just curious about that.
Yeah, well, he learns about her after that. So he tails her secretly, tails Evelyn. And the plot is still just unfolding until the very, very end of the movie. And he sees this woman being sort of held hostage, it looks like, through the window. And he assumes it's the mistress, right?
Right. Well, that is, you know, to go back on my earlier statement, I think that is the time that Evelyn does lie to him and
right.
say, you know, I'm just looking out for her. I feel bad for her.
Right. Then we learn from Escobar that salt water was found in Mulray's lungs.
Yeah.
And it's all starting to come together. And once you've seen this movie, when you go back and watch it a few times, there are all these great little things laid out along the way.
Yeah.
Like when he sees the water garden in the back of the house, and the groundskeeper says it's
bad for the grass.
Bad for the glass is what he says at first.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
You know, because he's Asian and he gets the L's and R's confused. And Jack's like, bad for the glass. What do you mean? He gets interrupted, but he sees something in the water kind of shimmer. Can't get it because Evelyn comes out there. But then later on, he realizes that he meant bad for the grass. That's a saltwater pool. Saltwater was found in the lungs. He fishes these glasses out, which he thinks are Mulray's glasses. And he obviously puts it together that Mulray was drowned in the backyard of his own home.
Right, but even at that point, he still thinks that Evelyn did it.
Yeah,
I mean, she's there, he's there, it makes perfect sense.
And the viewer thinks that Evelyn did it, I think. Like, if you know, the first time you see this movie, I don't know if you can go back there, but you don't really know what's going on. It's clues are laid, but nothing is ever, like, directed so blatantly where you're like, oh, well, I got this figured out.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, it's all stitched together. That's why they call it the perfect movie, I suppose.
And then in that final 10 minutes, that's where you learn the truth in that one scene, which now is a bit of a trope, like, and obviously completely wrong that, you know, you slap a woman.
Oh, sister, daughter.
Yeah, but it's so powerful to see that scene when he's slapping her and she's going, she's my sister, she's my daughter, she's my sister, she's my daughter. And knowing that's when you learn what this really is about is incest.
Right.
Which, like, fucking, it hits like an atom bomb in that movie, reveal.
It's the end. It is the unconceivable end of the line that in terms of, from a writing standpoint, when you think about how do you take this to its logical conclusion?
Yeah.
This is like 7 miles past that.
Yeah. So, you know, you learn that John Huston's character, Noah Cross, is raped his daughter when she was 15, Faye Dunaway. They had a baby together.
She doesn't ever, you know what I found? It was just one of those touches that's just so sophisticated. When he says, oh, he raped you.
She doesn't answer, does she?
She's kind of like, eh, yeah. Maybe. You know, I mean, there's still a sense, at least the way I interpreted that, you know, she was complicit in being molested by her father.
Yeah. Or complicit in that she couldn't fight back You know what I mean?
Right. Maybe. Yeah. I kind of read it as like what, which
it is very ambiguous.
It is. I kind of read it as like what you hear a lot from victims of abuse, that they harbor a lot of guilt because they viewed the relationship as some sort of romantic relationship, and therefore they were partly to blame.
Right.
And that's how I read it. But
yeah. Maybe. Well, I mean, I know people that have gone through that.
Yeah.
And they have been unpacking that shit since it happened.
Yeah.
Because if something like that goes on, and what's not known in this movie, if it was a one-time thing or if it was abuse over the course of years, but that's where that damage is truly done, when it's over the course of years and years where you are complicit to a certain degree because you're a fucking kid.
Right.
And you don't, you're totally being taken advantage of and exactly. manipulated.
Yeah.
And, you know, with Polanski, we might as well go and talk about.
Oh, let's do it.
I mean, it was a few years after where he was obviously, very famously arrested and tried and convicted of what they called then statutory rape. But as the stories came out of the year, just straight up rape. I mean, she was younger, but by all accounts, he totally like drugged and forced himself, even though he denied that. And he said it was consensual.
Right.
That's certainly not the case.
Yeah, well, I mean, There is no such thing as consensual sex with a minor.
Yeah, who has had Quaaludes and champagne and, right. you know, kind of the way that went down is just truly despicable.
Yeah, you know, what it constantly brings me to is, what do we do with artists in history from Herodotus to
Woody Allen,
Michael Jackson,
sure.
Oscar Wilde, keep on and on. What do we do with their art?
I know.
What do we do with the Cosby Show?
I know.
And I don't have an answer.
I don't either.
I don't suggest anything. It's just one of those things that just baffles me.
I know.
Polanski is both a monster and a genius, and a lot of monsters are geniuses. Is potentially
yeah.
what the you know maybe the easy lesson is. But also you know, and I think about, man, what is Hollywood? There's an awful lot of people in Hollywood that have kind of giving that guy a pass,
right?
You know, mentioning Woody Allen's another good example of that.
Yeah, but do you go back now and write off every movie that Harvey Weinstein ever touched?
Maybe you should.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it certainly saddens me to think that thought.
Yeah,
but it's equally or more saddening to think about the pain he's caused people's you know
right.
lives along the way as he made those movies.
Well, and then you find yourself. Reckoning with yourself, like, well, he was just the producer. Producers, he didn't make the movie.
Mm.
So you can still appreciate Reservoir Dogs, even
right.
though, you know, Harvey Weinstein championed that movie, right? And you make deals with yourself so you can still watch art that
yeah.
you like that was made by awful people.
Yeah.
And if all the stories of all the awful people ever throughout history that have ever made art came out, you're knocking a lot of people off the pedestal.
You are.
Rightfully, so. But again, there are no easy answers.
There aren't. All I know to do is just see it both ways and try to see the make sure that the dark doesn't overshadow the light and the light doesn't
yeah.
you know, drown out the dark.
Yeah. I'd be curious to hear from people. What they think, because I certainly don't blame anyone for drawing a hard line and being like, fuck that, they're dead to me and everything they ever made is dead to me, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah, I certainly would never pass judgment on that. I mean,
but Chinatown's a perfect movie.
It's pretty damn perfect. Hey, did you know Peter Bogdanovich was supposed to direct this thing?
Oh, really? Was
yeah.
this after Last Picture Show?
Yeah, so it was Evans' first movie as an independent producer, right? So he had been at Paramount for whatever, 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kid stays in the picture and that whole thing.
Yeah.
This was his first film outside of that, and he wanted Peter to direct it. But ultimately, you know, I forget exactly what happened, but ultimately Polanski got it. I guess Jack was going to potentially direct it. Oh, should we talk about Jack too? Like, just as a stalwart of American
yeah.
cinema. What are your thoughts?
I mean, he's Jack Nicholson. He's one of the best. Because he's managed to pull this magic trick in his career, I think, where he completely embodies characters while also being Jack.
Right.
At the same time. And usually it's one or the other.
Exactly. I heard Kubrick say something about, he got critiqued, and it was from, I forget who, let's say it was Scorsese, or it may have been Spielberg, or may have even been Stephen King, about Jack's performance in The Shining. And basically the conversation, as I remember, it was something like, hey, Stanley, look, you know, I love you, but that movie was a miss. It was just a flat out miss. And Stanley's like, what the fuck are you talking about? And he said, Jack's performance is so broad, it takes you out of the movie. And it, I think, illustrates what I've always thought about Jack, which is it's almost like, you know, that thing on modern TVs that people can turn off or on. It's a setting that I guess it's called like frame smoothing or something like that.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Okay, it makes it look like a fucking soap opera.
Right.
And it's the worst setting.
Right. So my father-in-law has that on his big giant TV and he's watching like Twilight Zone.
Same here, dude.
And yeah, and he doesn't notice, you know how it makes everything look like it was shot on video.
Yeah,
like,
Emily calls it dailies mode.
Yeah. My father-in-law doesn't detect that.
Yep, same. My father-in-law's
like,
the same way.
Doesn't see it at all. Or like cilantro, you know, some people it's awesome on a taco and other people it tastes like dish soap.
Yeah.
I feel like Jack is that. You either see that thing, you see the Jack thing
yeah.
as the reason he is what he is or
yeah.
the thing that makes him...
Well, yeah, I mean, so much about his iconic roles is in his Jackness.
Exactly. However, in this film, I feel like he's not doing Jack. I mean, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, he's J.J. Gittes for sure.
Yeah, which is an interesting thing because certainly on either side of this film, and obviously Cuckoo's Nest just after that was full Jack.
Yeah, and he just has a way of reading a line, man. Yeah. It's just a gift.
Yeah,
of spitting out. Like with the Venetian blinds, that first line in the movie, you know, it's just so perfect.
Yeah.
I've said that word a lot. And let's talk about the end. Perhaps the most unsatisfying ending in movie history.
You said unsatisfying.
Yeah. The
wow.
wrong people die, the wrong people get away scot-free.
Yeah.
It's just a fucking gut punch.
Yeah, it is.
You know, the end of the film, it all comes out that father is a rapist, incestual rapist. She tries to get her daughter out of there, shoots him in the arm. The way that last scene is played out is a little goofy when you look at it.
Yeah.
But she takes off down the street, and what you want more than anything is for her father to be brought to justice and for her to get away. And that cop goes out in the street shooting just blindly down the streets of Chinatown.
Yeah.
Shoots her through the fucking eyeball.
Yeah.
Dead on the horn of the car, granddaughter/daughter freaking out, and the cops are like, get everyone out of here. Like, Noah Cross, you're free to go with the spawn that you have created.
Yeah.
And she's dead, and it's just like a gut punch.
Do you get the sense that Escobar and the other guy are they under Noah Cross's...
Well, she says he owns the police. That's one of her last lines when, I don't know, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, that would explain why he just starts shooting at her.
Yeah. Yeah. I never really thought about that, if they were actually in on it, or if it was just like, here's the rich and powerful Noah Cross that we all know, so I have to, you know, this woman shot at him.
Yeah.
And she's looks like the bad guy right now.
Yeah. Maybe I'm a pessimist, but you saying it was an unsatisfying ending is interesting because, of course, it is, especially in
so
you know,
dark
in cinema terms. but for me, I've always struggled with especially in trying to make things and you know TV shows, films, or whatever that down endings aren't that a down ending can't be satisfying. For me,
yeah.
it's a very satisfying ending because it, I think it confirms maybe my worldview.
Yeah.
Which is that.
I know what you mean.
Yeah. I mean, it's that powerful people get away
yeah.
with, you know, with whatever, often, with
yeah.
whatever they want. And so it feels.
As a piece of art, it's satisfying. I know what you mean.
Yeah.
Because it is real and dark. And I don't need a happy ending on every movie.
Right.
But it leaves you just dejected. as a viewer.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it says, okay, yeah, there's how the world is.
Yep.
And that's not, I guess that there's an irony to calling that a satisfying thing, but
yeah.
But it does, it is at the very least, maybe one of the ballsiest decisions in cinema history to use that ending.
Yeah, and they...
I'm sure they shot an alt.
Well, I don't know if they... I don't think they shot an alt, but I did dig this up. Very famously contentious production, and Polanski and Town and Evans all fought a lot about the script. And apparently there were a couple of months where they just locked themselves in a room and fought about the script. And Robert Town said this: "We fought every day over everything. Names. What's her name? No, it can't be that. It's too ethnic. It's this. No, it's that." And then they came into conflict on whether, apparently there was narration early on, very noirish voiceover that Polanski lost.
Right.
Which I think is probably the right move.
Good call.
But the ending apparently was a major bone of contention. Robert Towne had written a conclusion where Evelyn survived and killed her father, but Polanski was in a dark place. This was just a few years after his wife was brutally murdered by the Manson family.
Yeah.
So he was, you know, he was making movies that reflected that. I think everyone kind of knows that. And Polanski said, "I thought it was a serious movie, not an adventure story for the kids." He said, whereas Town said, "You know what? Your wife died. Beautiful blondes die in Los Angeles. That's just what happens." So he didn't budge. And Roman finally said, "I want it written this way." And Town said, "I think it would be very bad if I wrote it that way." And he said, "Try it anyway." So I did. I brought it back to him and said, "See, it's so melodramatic." And Roman said, "No, it's perfect." And that was that. So Roman's the one who, Polanski's the one who wanted to stick to that dark ending. And apparently he, you know, Town wanted it the other way, which I don't know if it would be a happy ending, but at least it would be a little more satisfying for the bad guy to get caught.
Right. I heard an interesting, funny story. I don't know if it's true, but and I forget where I heard it. But apparently when they were shooting one of the scenes in the car, Faye Dunaway, like, you know, it's hurry up and wait on set, of course. And Faye Dunaway yelled out to Roman Polanski, "Hey, how much
they
time?"
They battled a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So she was like, "Hey, how much time do I have? I need to go pee," right? And he was like, "Sit still. We're about to shoot." Like, and then he's over there doing 15 things and forgets that she said that. And basically he was just like, "Sit down, shut up.
Right.
We'll be with you in a moment." He goes over to the car eventually to give some kind of direction or something like that. And the window is down and she has a cup full of piss.
No way.
Right in the face.
Throws it on him.
Yeah.
I hope that story's true.
Yeah. And he's like, "What the fuck?"
Wow. All right. So that line I said earlier, that when Jake in earlier in the movie, when they said, what did you do for the police force? And he said, "As little as possible." That line comes back at the very end. You almost miss it. He's looking at Faye Dunaway's eyeball shot out, her head shot out, speechless. It's just a chaotic scene. And he mutters under his breath, "As little as possible."
Yeah.
And that's where that line comes back. And maybe the best last line in movie history, you know, the Escobar's like, "Get him out of here. I'm doing you a favor. Get him out of here. Take your friend and get him out of here." And the guy goes up to him and says, "Forget about it, Jake. It's Chinatown."
Yeah.
And it's just like, I got goosebumps now thinking about it.
Yeah.
Just such a bow on the end of that movie with that line.
Yeah, it really, really is. What else should we say, Tuckers?
Well, I don't have anything else.
Did you know Evans was convicted of cocaine trafficking?
Oh, yeah. That was the kid stays in the picture.
When I knew we were going to do this, I was like, I don't know a ton about him. And I've seen that movie. I guess I'd just forgotten about that.
Well, that's where True Romance kind of got that whole thing with the Hollywood producer running cocaine.
Right
was
on.
Based on Robert Evans. All right, we finish with what Ebert said in 5 questions.
Oh, yeah. What did Ebert say?
This movie is a complete disappointment.
Ebert gave it 4 stars. The crimes in Chinatown include incest and murder, but the biggest crime is against the city's own future by men who see that to control the water is to control the wealth. At one point, Geddes asked millionaire Noah Cross why he needs to be richer. How much better can you eat? What can you buy that you can't already afford? And Cross replies, "The future, Mr. Gitz. the future. Of course, he mispronounces his name through the whole movie. And like most noir stories, Chinatown ends in a flurry of revelation. All is explained, relationships are redefined, and justice is done or not. Town writes, of my eventual conflict with Roman and enduring disappointment over the literal and ghoulishly bleak climax of the movie. Certainly the wrong people are alive at the end of the film and dead, but I'm not sure Polanski was wrong. So I kind of agree, man.
Yeah.
That bleak ending really, it's a gut punch, but it was necessary almost, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know that we'd be sitting here talking about that movie if it weren't for that ending.
I had like a sunny, happy ending.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Five questions, bud. What's the first movie you saw in the theater?
Christine.
Stephen King. Right. Of course. You mentioned earlier. First R-rated movie might have been Christine. Was
it was
that
definitely R-rated.
Yeah?
Yeah.
All right. So that's a double whammy. Your first movie in the theater was R-rated.
I guess so.
How old were you?
I don't know. I'd have to do the math. What year was that? I was born in 77. I want to say that was maybe,
85 or something.
3 or 4. It was like pre-Gremlins is all I can remember. Which I think there's a connection here. I want to say Jerry Goldsmith wrote the score for Gremlins.
Oh, really?
Wrote the score for Chinatown.
Oh, well, the score for Chinatown. We didn't even mention.
Yeah.
I think I saw somewhere that he wrote that score in like a week or something.
Not surprising. Let's see.
Christine, 1983. Yeah.
Well, there you go. So I was 6.
A little young for Christine.
Of course it was. Are you kidding? It's crazy.
Will you walk out of a bad movie?
You know,
I know you don't get to the theater a ton anymore.
I don't think so. I often fall asleep in movies.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Even at home, my whole family gets very angry at me. I actually think that it's
probably you wake up at like fucking 5 in the morning, don't you?
Yeah, 4:30, whatever. I think it's some sort of like road hypnotism.
Yeah.
I watch things that have been edited all day,
uh-huh,
and I don't fall asleep when I'm like giving notes on things that I've made or whatever. But for whatever reason, watching a film, I think it's 24 frames a second does something to my brain and I immediately go to sleep. So I don't, I'm usually asleep.
All right. Yeah. Did you rewatch this, by the way, this week?
I did.
Oh, okay. I thought you had, but. All right. Number 4, this is for you. What movie do you wish you had directed?
Wow. Man, there's so many that I would love to take credit for, and many I've tried to rip off. Man, I'm gonna say, I think a hell of a lot of Harmony Korine.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, a film like Gummo is something.
Wow.
That I come back to that.
Uh-huh.
It's really, it's such an achievement on so many levels in terms of what that film was.
Yeah.
It's not a very popular film necessarily. But also, I mean, there's some documentaries that have a huge influence on me, like American Movie.
Yeah. So great.
To go make American Movie would probably be my ultimate.
All right. And I'll update everyone from the 13 or 14 texts you're going to send me over the next few days about what movie you wish you would have
directed. I'm sure when I think about it more. Yeah.
All right. And finally, Movie Going 101, when you get out to the theater, what's your deal? Where do you sit? What do you eat?
Pretty boring that way. Sit in the middle.
Yeah.
Usually sit where my kids want to sit now. They're cool. They like good stuff. So
yeah,
we'll go see some stuff. Haven't seen Black Klansman yet. That's probably the next thing we'll see.
Yeah, I've heard that's good.
Yeah. It's a pretty fucked up story.
I mean, like, yeah, true story too,
amazing.
Right?
Yeah. So I used to be a major sugar addict, like famously. And so I would typically, my standard order would be that giant bag of M&Ms, followed by that giant bag of Reese's Pieces.
Oh, wow.
Those big movie theater bags. And a giant Coke. Now, Casey's got me on the wagon. So
are you off sugar altogether?
Yeah,
pretty much.
Yeah, I lost 20 pounds like in 3 weeks.
Yeah, you look good.
Thank you. You too.
All right, thanks, brother.
Thank you, man.
This is good.
Bye.
All right, everybody. Hope you enjoyed that. That was a great conversation, Chad and I. Have had many conversations just like this over the years, not in front of a microphone, and it was a pleasure to sit down and have him in the studio. such a good friend, and just really great taste in movies and culture and TV and films and literature and music. Chad always is turning me on to something great that I didn't know about before. And I'm glad we got to talk about Chinatown. Hope we did it justice. I felt like we got into a pretty good deep dive on this one, which I always love. And it was a lot of fun. So thanks to Chad for coming in. You can go check out School of Humans. Go to their website, see what they're up to, and look for Hell and Gone, which is coming out very soon. It's a new true crime podcast that he's working with us on. A very, very cool story about a woman, an investigator from Arkansas, a little tiny town in Arkansas, where there's a cold case from one of her sister's friends that was very sadly, brutally murdered. And she has left Arkansas, has now gone back, and is investigating this crime. And it should be really, really good. I'm looking forward to that getting out into the world. So look for Hell and Gone soon. And hope you enjoyed this one on Chinatown. And until next time, seriously, forget about it. It's Chinatown. Movie Crush is produced, engineered, edited, and soundtracked by Noel Brown and Ramsey Yunt at HowStuffWorks Studios, Ponce City Market, Atlanta, Georgia.